I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Calaveras County.
Good morning, Tom. I'm Martin Hubbardy, and welcome to Murphy's, California, Queen of the Sierra.
So what do you do here for a day job?
For a day job, I've got five day jobs, I think, at the moment. It's a small town, and do you remember that I Love of Lucy episode where she's constantly changing hats, whatever job she's doing? I run the Calaveras Visitors Bureau and Film Commission.
And you took on those by choice, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love it. It keeps me busy. It keeps me out of trouble. And then I also run the Angels Camp Museum, which is a wonderful gold rush museum. And I'm also District 3 Calaveras supervisor, county supervisor.
When do you sleep?
I don't.
Yeah.
Your job becomes your life, and, mm-hmm. and it all intertwines. It all intertwines in it, and I love it.
So you're definitely ADD?
Yes.
Yeah.
Totally. Might as well just, put my hand up, guilty as charged. I've always loved this area, and to be able to help promote it and mm-hmm. bring people in, I think, Tom, honestly, the pandemic introduced this area to a lot of people. They came that first year because they were looking for out-of-the-way places that they'd never been before. And they've come back because they see how cool it is here and how much fun stuff there is to do. And the quaint Gold Rush towns, moreover than anything, it's the people that live here.
Mm-hmm.
It's a phenomenal place, and the people really enjoy visitors and bringing people in and then saying goodbye, and we'll see you next time.
And it's not just hermits. I mean, you guys do phenomenal job of events and getting the community together. You got one coming up.
I do. Murphy Irish Days. It's a phenomenal event. And ultimately, I think that's how people found us in the past and how they come back are our events. And last year, we had 12,000 people, if you can believe it, on our little downtown area. But unique events are really what this county is known for. And probably the most famous one is the Jumping Frog Jubilee, which has happened every year since 1928. Down at the fairgrounds, except for 2 years, 1 year during World War II and 1 year during COVID, we didn't do it.
Oh, interesting.
Of course, because of Mark Twain and the jumping frog at Calaveras County, and we've jumped frogs every year mm-hmm. since 1928.
That's so cool. 20, 30 years ago, I stayed at the Murphy's Hotel.
Oh, wow.
And as I remember, the GM said that Mark Twain had stayed there. Was that true? That George Washington slept here.
I think several famous people have signed that book that probably were somewhere else at the time that they actually were supposedly here signing the book.
Oh, interesting.
So I don't know for sure. It depends on who you talk to, but some have said that the Mark Twain signature isn't actually Mark Twain.
Interesting. So part of Murphy's, its allure is smoke and mirrors and legends and myths and greater good stuff. Tell us about how that became, kind of ramped up the town and its mystique.
What's so interesting about Calaveras is it seems that our towns sort of have their independent heydays. Me growing up, Murphy's was pretty much dead for quite a while. And at first it was Angel's Camp, and then it was Arnold during the 60s and 70s when the lumber industry was booming up there and everything was brand spanking new and the golf course was gorgeous. And then really Murphy started to turn around in the late 70s, 80s, and then it really in the last 20 years it's come into its own. And a lot of that has to do with the wine industry, mm-hmm. which Bard and Stevenot sort of rejuvenated in the late 70s. It's a wonderful place for people to come and have a break. And we're close enough to have a day break as well, so you don't have to come and stay, mm-hmm. although we really like people to come and stay.
Divert for a moment. Watercolor brush is now in your hand. Mm. Paint an auditory picture of just at least Main Street and where we are, because it is so evocative and so seductive, the town.
Yeah. Tom, let me say it's then and now, because you can be walking down the street and you can look at a building and it looks exactly the same way as it did in 1850s.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the hotel that you've been talking about was built in 1856. It hasn't changed. So you can be looking at pictures from the 1850s, and it's exactly the same building, which is fantastic.
Contextually, every building in town might have been an 1880 build, but it's still frozen in time.
Frozen in time. Yeah. Unfortunately, the town burned twice. I believe it's only twice. But everything went. And then that's when they started building things with stone. There's still buildings in downtown. For example, I believe it's Allegory, which is a wine tasting room, was originally built as a cheap cash store. Still has a foot and a half of dirt on the roof, because that's how they
protected.
Exactly, from the fire from coming through the building.
And I love the steel fire shutter doors.
Those are great. Yeah. They're great. And fortunately, we have enough of those. Actually, I've got like six sets down at the museum. I'm trying to find which building they should go on to, because, there was a period where everybody wanted to modernize. And so you really do get that flavor when you're walking down the street, that, mm-hmm. that you're walking through history.
So you probably do some living history, right? Historical society characters.
Exactly. I mean, the historical society in Calaveras is very strong. So we have two big museums. There's one in San Andreas, which I think is the gem of Calaveras, and the Angels Camp Museum, which has a world-class carriage house. I've never seen anything else like it. I think, honestly, how you treat your history says a lot about who you are as a society, and we're devoted to our history. That's why people come, too, because they want to experience that. Along with that history comes a feeling of community and homespunness that I think that when our visitors come, they feel like they're part of the community, and that's the secret, I think, is really making them feel like this is their home, too.
But it's really a ma and pa town.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, what's your grocery store?
Well, our grocery store it's called Sierra Hills. We call it Sierra Thrills. And we actually have a natural food market. I know for years people were trying to get a Trader Joe's up here, but we have our natural food market, and it's a small town market. The problem is you can't go to the market without expecting to spend a couple hours in there because you get caught. And then you're chatting.
Conversation.
Exactly. Yeah. You're just stuck in the aisles. And it's funny enough, but you can walk into the store now, and I bet you there'll be three groups of people stuck in the aisles talking.
I live in a small town. You go on a doggy walk, you have to plan on double time.
Right.
Because everybody wants to stop and visit with your dog.
True.
It's something precious and coveted, or should be coveted, what you guys have, because it's rare and rare around the world and around California.
Well, Tom, the secret is the balance, because ultimately it is the balance of bringing people in so that we have the restaurants and that we have, I know it sounds ridiculous, but we have the grocery stores and the gas stations that we do, because visitors really support that. But you also have to keep the quality of life for the locals. You know, there are a lot of people that moved here and that want that quiet lifestyle. We want to bring people in who want to engage in our community, engage in our lifestyle too. Mm-hmm. So
is there a mandate for restricting like big corporate flag hotels coming in or casinos and whatnot to protect what you have?
I'm changing my, I love Lucy, I'm putting my supervisor hat on right now. Yes. I mean, ultimately, there's a huge drive to keep this a very rural community, and big box stores have been voted out many times. In my lifetime, I don't see any in this area. You know, we do have, for example, in Angels Camp, which is the next town down, we do have a Tractor Supply, and so there are stores that are coming in that service our area, and there are a lot of locals that don't want to have to drive out of the county for services. So I think you'll see other parts of the county providing those services, but I think the upper Highway 4 corridor, we're very protective.
That's really cool, because that seems essential and central to preservation.
Yeah, we have to retain our character, and we don't want to look like every other place. Yeah.
And how about subdivision in growth and development that is also, you know, done right can be okay, but it also can be a despoiler.
Again, as with my supervisor hat on, I feel very strongly that we do not get overdeveloped. We're at a good balance right now, but infrastructure is a huge issue. A lot of our infrastructure is antiquated and can't support more growth. Also, from an evacuation standpoint.
One way in, one way out.
Exactly. We're in wildfire country, and I want to make sure that everybody can get out. So if you overdevelop without building the roads that you need, and the topography around here is such that, you know, that's going to be difficult.
Driving through the Sierras, I noticed a lot of thinning of forests going on. Is that happening here?
Yes.
To create defensible spaces?
There's one individual in particular. He alone in this area has received, I believe it's $6 million worth of grants to do mastication and thinning so that we're protecting our communities.
Yeah. I met with Sierra Conservancy a while back. At that time, the head said that 50% of the trees in the Sierras are dead or dying. Like, wow. So how do you deal with that? And that would imply preventative thinning and logging.
Yes. There's several different schools of thought with people that we have, just with our grove that we have here of the giant sequoias. Funny enough, this was the first place that the giant sequoias were discovered. George O'Dowd in 1852 was chasing a grizzly bear and went into the grove and found, again, that's lore. I'm sure that there were other people before him, but for the most part, he was the first person. And as I was saying, George O'Dowd discovered the park in 1852, but what's so interesting now are the various groups who want to conserve the park and what is the best science going forward. And it's been very interesting to see the amount of work that's been done. And there are a lot of people that are working very hard to protect our sequoias, because really, you know, thousands of years can go away in just a couple of days if they're not protected properly. So that is our major concern in this area, beyond protecting our towns.
Paradise, California. There are shades of paradise here.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And it almost makes you not want to go there and think about it.
Well, you know, I think it's... There are two things that I'm trying as a supervisor to combat that. And number one, a little backstory. I know we were talking earlier. I went to school in England, and I lived in a house. It was a boarding school, and there were 75 kids in our house. And I was a prefect, and every month we had the fire alarm go off at various times during the day. And one morning at 5:30, it went off, and nobody wanted to get up and out of bed, especially as it was freezing out. But, you know, prefect, get up, get all the kids downstairs out of the building. We were out in 2.5 minutes. There was nothing left of the building in five minutes. It was gone.
Wow.
And if we hadn't have practiced, we would not have gotten out. And I really feel that what we try and instill in people here is know how to get out. Make sure you're prepared. Make sure you have your cat carrier, dog carrier standing by. And I think that people, you know, we call them go bags, and everybody prepares a go bag. It's just hugely important to have the practice and to have the right information.
And communication. We were talking about that earlier today.
Yeah.
I mean, cell phone. What if the cell towers go down?
Yeah.
How do you get word out to people?
We've had these issues, and then there's the question of bringing back sirens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and do sirens really work? For the most part, I know that our sheriff is working on a box that theoretically could go into every house. So even if you lose cell, you will get your emergency information because it works through radio frequencies.
How are we doing on time?
We're good.
Okay, what I want to do is loop back to visitor survey.
Yes.
Somebody wants to come here. How do you find out about where you stay, what you have,
great,
et cetera? Tell us about somebody that has not been here. Maybe they're flying into SFO and they want to do a little exploring. How do they get here? What's the attraction? Why should they detour? Because it is a detour to get here.
Yeah. Well, actually, Tom, I'm going to correct you on that. It's not a detour. You can actually come and stay here.
Right.
And we are 2 hours from Lake Tahoe. 2 hours from Yosemite.
So you can do it in Rose then.
Yeah, and that's what I try and get people to do, because it's less expensive. You could have that hometown feeling, you know, go to your local restaurants, but also, actually, we find a lot of people that come from England. Most of our international travelers are from England, and they're looking for that two-week holiday. So what I try and sell a lot is come stay in Calaveras, and you can do San Francisco, Yosemite, Lake Tahoe, and my favorite is driving over Highway 4, going to Bodie, and then coming back over Highway 108. And just making an amazing loop through the Sierras.
Mm-hmm. I have friends from Germany and come to SFO or LAX and do the wine country and all the way over to Vegas.
People are looking for new experiences and out of the normal beaten path, and quirky. And we have quirky like no other.
If you had a hierarchical cell here, Murphy's, what would be your number one thing you would want to talk to me about to share? Why come to Murphy's?
I'm going to go back to it's that homespun feeling, that visitors who come here feel like it's their home too. We're very welcoming, and we want to be welcoming. We want to engage our visitors, and there's enough here to do in Murphy's and the surrounding areas to keep people here and keep them interested, and we have something for everyone. So I'd say, moreover than anything, the first thing that comes to me when I drive, and you mentioned it on the way here, is space. And I think that you have space here. I know that sounds kind of silly to say, but there's just this feeling of kind of letting go and just letting the nature talk to you, and, you know, being surrounded in a beautiful area. I'd say that that's probably primarily what I would want to market is, you know, come have space to think and be in a beautiful place and yet have enough to do to keep you interested.
Moment, looping back on places to stay, small hotels, family-owned, inns, VRBOs.
We are primarily, honestly, since the boon of the Airbnb and the short-term rentals, that's primarily what people are looking for up here, having their little getaway all to themselves, but being able to engage in town. We have wonderful, I mean, we're in a wonderful B&B right now. You know, the Dunbar House, this is historic and got a lot of character. And I think that that's also what I should say about Murphy's and Calaveras County is we're not only quirky, but we have a lot of character.
So talk to us about, you're here now and you're in your little getaway, hideaway, but you need to get out and explore. What would be your priority best picks?
Our number one place that you can't miss is the Calaveras Big Trees. And it's a grove of 1,000 giant sequoias. And if you've never seen a giant sequoia, pictures don't do it justice. You have to see it in person because you just can't believe how big these trees are. They're the largest living thing on earth. And You know, some of them are purportedly 3,000 years old.
Wow.
And walking amongst the giants is a spiritual experience. I mean, you will never forget it. I don't care who you are. You're going to be moved by seeing these. As well as our caverns. We have three caverns in Calaveras. Moaning Cavern, it's the largest single chamber cavern in California. You could fit the Statue of Liberty in it.
Wow.
It has a spiral staircase that was made out of an old battleship that goes down 160 feet, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Don't quote me on that, but it's about that. It is an experience unlike, and when I was talking to you about space, I've never been underground and felt so much space. Mm-hmm. And it is cavernous. I know that's ridiculous to say, but right. It is millions of years old.
And there's another one I was driving.
Yes, there's Mercer Caverns, and then there's California okay. Caverns. And California Caverns floods during the winter, so that only is open at various times of the year. But Mercer and Moaning, and when you go in the wintertime and the walls are sort of weeping with the water, mm-hmm. and that's what made it moan, actually, was the actual sound of the water inside the cavern that then went through the hole at the top.
Wow.
And
so, spooky
yes.
place for
yeah.
the Native Americans.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I gotta divert for a moment. This is incredible. I was back in eastern Tennessee in a real small town, and the PR woman wanted to drop me off at this cave. She said, when you go down about 9 layers, you know, way down in the cave, you come to a 10-acre lake, and there are boats on the lake, and
wow.
there are 20-pound trout in the lake. Because nobody
yeah.
could figure out where the water went from
wow.
this lake, how it
wow.
got there and where it went. So they, we'll put baby trout in and then we'll tag them. We'll see where they go. They never left.
Wow.
And they have no predators. So they're like these little.
Huge.
Yeah.
Wow.
And they come right up to your boat.
Oh, wow.
When you're touring around.
They can't go anywhere. That's so weird.
I know. Anyway, sorry for the
no,
diversion.
No, that's a great story.
Yeah, I mean, it is.
It's about adventure, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that everybody that comes here, it's like traveling anywhere, though. Everybody's going to have their own unique experience and what
mm-hmm.
have you. But if you're looking for adventure, you're going to find it here. If you're looking for a place just to get away, you're going to find it here.
Lakes, kayaking.
Paddleboarding is huge.
Mm-hmm.
We have more people coming up and paddleboarding. Yeah, our mountain lakes are amazing.
Right nearby, right?
Yes, no, just right up the road. So we have three amazing reservoirs, Utica Union and Spicer. And again, there are no motorized boats that
mm-hmm.
are allowed. So it's all paddleboards, kayaking, swimming. I mean, crystal clear water. This is all snowmelt that these reservoirs were built to, you know, again, for water for the miners. And the infrastructure for bringing that water down the hill still exists. And when you drive through our area, you can still see parts of the flume that were built 170 years ago.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
All right, well, I could keep you all day, but I know you've got to get on. Before we go, loop back for a moment the history and the current status of your wine industry and how it's a draw.
Thank you. I know I talked about Bard and Stephen O earlier and the rebirth of the wine industry in Calaveras, but you're going to be very lucky to talk to a woman named Gay Callen today. She is just the best and is a pioneer here in California. I mean, Calaveras, California too. I always say the people that live in this area have a bit of that pioneer spirit within them, and Gay is a true pioneer and an entrepreneur, and it is Women's History Month to be celebrated, and she is a woman with a lot of history in this area, and I can't wait for you to talk to her about the wine industry and how it all came about.
Very cool.
She was here from the beginning. And then also, I believe you've got Bonnie coming in, Bonnie Randall, and Bonnie is new to the area and is an entrepreneur herself with her husband, and they've opened a distillery. And they're just back from these incredible awards. You have to ask her about the awards that they've just won, but they've won 9 awards internationally.
Wow.
And nationally. And
they're a new startup?
A new startup. She started during the COVID. Yeah, it just amazing success story. Again, it's a wonderful, quirky business
mm-hmm.
that's incredibly successful here, and people need to know about. And that's up in Arnold.
That's so cool. Well, I love spirits.
Good. Well, I should tell her to bring some so you can taste
them
for you.
Okay, I'm coming back for more.
Please do. You're welcome anytime.
Yeah,
I'd love to have you back.
Yeah, we'll dig deeper.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
Oh, you too. Okay, to learn more about your world, where would you direct us?
Oh, please look us up online at gocalaveras.com. You can always call the office. Our telephone number is 209-736-0049. We have a wonderful staff, and we're open 7 days a week. You can always stop by either one of our, in Angels Camp, we're open 7 days a week. In Murphy's, we're open for 5. Stop by our visitor center and look for us. And hashtag Go Calaveras. And my name is Martin Huberty, and I run the Visitors Bureau here in Calaveras County. And thank you very much, Tom, for coming to visit.
Oh, it's my honor. What a blessing. I'm so glad I got to meet you.
Thank you.
It's cool. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Calaveras County. We'll see you here. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer, reporting from the heart of the Redwoods and the legendary gold country town of Murphy's, California. Come along and join me for a visit with wine expert Gay Callen of Chatham Vineyards. Growing grapes and crafting fine wine since 1980, Callen is a legendary pioneer of the Sierra Foothills wine industry. Come along and join Miss Callen to discover the rest of the story.
Gay Callen, and I am the owner of Chatham Vineyards, which is located between Angels Camp and San Andreas in Calaveras County.
How cool. How did this happen for you to become a winemaker and a vintner and a grower?
To make a really long story short, the Chatham family came over in the early 1800s and landed in the Central Valley. And in the late 1970s, we were able to diversify. And I was born and raised in San Francisco, worked in a wine shop with some friends of mine. And the opportunity for putting in a vineyard was very attractive at the time.
Late 70s, what varietal did you think you were going to be good at?
I was working with computers. So I thought I would just be a weekend warrior wherever it was that we ended up. Mm-hmm. And we had a ranch consultant that knew Barden Stevino. And Barden had Stevino Winery up here and a vineyard. He was also working in real estate. So we connected with him.
He was one of the grandfathers of the modern iteration of the wine industry here. Yeah.
He was really the pioneer of getting all of this started in Calaveras County. Well, there is an older vineyard. I believe it's the Ghirardelli Vineyard. It was really Barden that started the wine industry. And the boom.
The first iteration, what did the best? What varietals? What were you guys known for?
Well, I planted the vineyard for Stevino. Initially, he wanted Chardonnay. He wanted Sauvignon Blanc. Mm-hmm. He wanted Cabernet, Merlot, Zinfandel. And he wanted a little bit of Semillon to blend with the Sauvignon Blanc.
So Semillon back in the day would be for a Sauternes, right?
Well, were French, yes.
Yeah.
Over the course of any number of years, I go back 45 years on this. When we started crafting our Sauvignon Blanc, it was more of a melon characteristic, so that we did a slight blend with our Semillon. But the initial planting was for Barden. And so with that being said, he was buying fruit from El Dorado, from Amador County. We also had Chenin Blanc. All of a sudden, you know, Chenin Blanc became the poor man's Chardonnay. People were grafting like crazy to remove their Chenin, which is now a very popular varietal in the marketplace. So Barden started cutting back on the varietals that he wanted from our vineyard. So in the early 1980s, I started having wines made for me. And
from your grapes?
From our grapes. And in the late 1980s, I don't know why we got this hairball idea of buying property and building our own winery. So while I was still furnishing some fruit to Stevino, we started building our own winery. And it was located on Highway 4 in Douglas Flat, which is now the Hatcher Winery. You know, the rest is history. Everything that we crafted from our own vineyard. I think the thing that really stands out with the history of winemaking here was the fact that nobody had heard of Calaveras County. They heard of Jumping Frog, Mark Twain. And so our history was more in gold and not in wine. So it was difficult, initially very difficult, to market a product that people were unfamiliar with the region. And it wasn't that we were just competing with Amador. We were the new kids on the block, so to speak.
But it would follow that, like San Francisco Chronicle Wine Competition.
And absolutely.
Those are the things that could propel you guys and make
it
you...
Did. Yeah. It did. We were lucky enough to have any number of awards from the San Francisco Chronicle tastings. We were in Variety magazine. We were in Vanity Fair. We were fortunate enough to be at Williams-Sonoma Wine Club.
Wow.
And so we really did. Mm-hmm. We were very fortunate in the success of where we were going.
Yeah.
Bringing in other interests was really fun because Barden was really the one that spearheaded it. And we would go, he and I, and there was Chispas Cellars, who was Bob Bliss, who then sold to the Olsons, and then there was Steve and Liz Millier. We formed the Calaveras Wine Grape Alliance, so there might have been eight of us at the time. And we all agreed to disagree or not agree or agree or whatever it was. It was a family. We were a family. And it still is a family. You know, all the wineries are family-owned and operated.
So today, what is your AVA called? And
we don't have
one. You don't? Wow.
We don't have
one. You don't want one?
It's, well, no, we do. It's very expensive, though, to get the AVA. Uh-huh. And we had looked into it when Barden was alive and, you know, when all of us were very, when it was very small, we looked into it.
But bottom line, whether you have the certification or not, you are by default a viticulture-growing region that is distinctive.
Yes.
Different than your neighbors.
It is different. The topography, for us, you have vineyards at sea level. Copperopolis is sea level. And then you have up to Bryce Station, which is 3,000 feet. Mountain Ranch is a little bit higher. So you have limestone, you have beautiful sandy loam soils, you have total rock strata.
And you want rocks, yeah?
You do,
yeah.
You do.
To what do they call
point.
About poor man's soil for,
pretty much.
For a rich man's wine?
Well, unfortunately, we seem to be growing rocks over the 45 years. So it can be very challenging when you're trying to irrigate and you're not getting the water into the soil. What was really fun is to see the expansion. You know, when initially it was just three of us, and then it was six of us. And now there are, I believe, 11 wineries, but 30-odd tasting rooms.
Interesting.
So a lot of the quote-unquote tasting rooms are having their wines crafted at the custom crush crafted at the wineries.
Interesting. So yourself, what do you have under estate rules that you're growing?
We did change the complexion of the vineyard over the course of the last 45 years. So we still have the Chardonnay. We are bringing back some of the Chenin that we had. We had Chenin that we grafted over to Merlot.
Mm-hmm.
So we're bringing back some of the Chenin.
Interesting.
We have Syrah.
Mm-hmm.
We have Sangiovese. We have Zinfandel, Semillon. I mentioned Merlot. We do have Merlot. We have Cabernet. We have five Portuguese varietals, and we have, is that 13? I'm trying to remember how many we have. We just planted some Albarino for one of the local wineries and some Grenache.
Wow, so you can do a real breadth of different varietals.
We can.
Yeah.
We're in our own little valley.
So within your valley, are there little microclimates where, you know, one little acre might do better for one grape?
Yeah. It's at the most northern portion of our vineyard, our soils are probably a good sandy loam, a good 8 to 10 feet deep, just gorgeous.
Isn't that interesting that 500 yards away is a different wine?
It's, you know, I knew nothing about grapes. I didn't need another degree. I went back to Davis and learned how to put the correct end of a grapevine in the soil, which was, really? Is that how that works? You know, it's funny because people ask me if I would do it all over again. Mm-hmm. And I said, if I knew then what I know now, I would do it very differently.
But you would still do it.
I would still do it. We looked in Napa, and there's not a lot of areas where you can get up in the morning and you can see the sunrise. And then in the afternoon, you see the sunset. And we have had snow. We're at 1,500 feet. We've had snow at the vineyard before. We've gotten through the drought. Mm-hmm. Water is always an issue for us. And right now there is a glut of fruit on the market.
Mm-hmm.
So it ebbs and flows. It's like a roller coaster ride.
Mm-hmm. But an interesting side, your reds, there's a long maturation process. You know, barrel aging and
Absolutely.
Bottle aging. So when it comes out the other end, it could be a different market.
When I had the winery, we worked more with the philosophy of old school, so that our reds, the heavier reds, the Merlots, the Cabernets, the Syrahs, would be in barrel anywhere from 24 to 36 months, then into bottle for a good year and a half to two. So by the time that we would release that wine, it was just beautiful. It was
just
elegant.
Prime.
It wasn't jammy, in-your-face kind of red. Our Sangiovese was more on the lighter style, so we always used neutral. But we were very mindful of not using certain formulas. And I think the vineyard itself and the topography and where things are planted, people would come back because they knew the quality and the style of wine that they were going to get.
Yeah, but that implies patience, because you're waiting another year or two for your return on investment. Some wineries can't afford.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Cash flow. Cash flow is never easy. It's.
But that can force you, maybe not you literally, but force you to push out a product sooner than you know it should wait.
Yes. You know, there's so many little gimmicks of aeration and you know, different things that different winemakers utilize to
push their envelope.
Push the envelope. And we didn't do that.
Yeah.
And I think that was...
So you were an old school purist then.
Kind of, yeah. If you'd ask my dad, he was a martini drinker, and so by the time he would have a glass of wine, he would call me and say he didn't like it, which... Okay, after a martini, I wouldn't either.
Yeah.
You know, I left that part of the industry because I had been on the road so much. It was time for me to let it go. And we had a great wine club, and we had a great time. It was also a good time to move it forward and come back to being a farmer.
Interesting. Although I got to interject for a moment, a wine club is a real brilliant model to reduce and simplify.
Yes.
I mean, you don't have to do the dog and pony show to go on the road, sales and whatnot, nearly as much if you have an in-house consumption of your wine.
That's very true. That's very true. I think that, you know, now with, I still belong to a number of wine clubs here locally because I want to support the industry here. I sell fruit to a number of the wineries here. And I think it's important that we maintain the friendships, but also the knowledge, and as a grower, you know, we maintain the knowledge of who's crafting what and how are they crafting it. You're right, wine clubs are the icing on the cake.
Brilliant. A friend of mine owns a winery down around Paso, and that was his godsend during COVID.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he just chugged on.
Yeah, you have to get, we noticed, and I think that when I said there is a glut of fruit on the market, COVID affected... Even though people were drinking a lot. People
were
drinking.
Yeah, you'd think they're doing more. Yeah.
It really affected sales to the point where that now we're feeling it, the grower is feeling it at this juncture. Over the years, you know, having any number of people come to us when we had the winery and then come to me asking me about what did they think of, you know, what kind of grape to plant or whatever. It's a beautiful community. It is spacious. Every area is totally different. Like, we're 8 miles outside of Angel's Camp in San Andreas, so I'm just over the hill from Murphy's. So I want to stay where I am, you know, in lieu of, oh, well, why don't you buy this piece of property and plant something over there? I said, I've got enough on my plate right now. But bringing more people into the region... Over the years, it's not just Chardonnay and Cabernet and Merlot anymore. You have the Tempranillos, you have the Barberas, you have. I think there's close to 50 different varietals that we have here now.
But is there one or two that are synonymous with what you guys in your local area are best at? That's a tough one.
It is a tough one. I mean, the Foothills is known for their Zinfandel, whether it's in Amador or not. I think that Tempranillo has come up, and I know that Barden and unfortunately, both Barden and Chuck Hovey are no longer with us, but they really introduced the Tempranillo to the community and region, and that does very well here.
It's fascinating what you're saying, because the classic Spanish varietal would do great, as would central northern France varietal. Your reds. I mean, that's fascinating.
Pinots do not do well up here, because it's not a cool enough, damp enough. I mean, you know, Pinots thrive with fog and, you know, Carneros thing.
So it's closer to the coast where they do better.
Yes.
In Northern California.
You know, when people say, oh, don't plant Chardonnay, our Chardonnay is just done so well.
Mm.
And our Sauvignon Blanc is a beautiful Sauvignon Blanc. Mm-hmm. It has more of a melon characteristic to it than that bone dry, grassy, you know, soft Blanc.
Is your Chardonnay a Fuente clone?
No, it's actually all of our fruit is on its own rootstock.
Oh, cool.
Which is kind of scary because, because way back when, you know, phylloxera has always...
Yeah, you weren't supposed to do that.
You weren't supposed to do that. But you know, Murphy's Law, anything could go wrong, I did. We didn't end up with... I better be knocking on wood with phylloxera,
but
we're very mindful of the equipment we bring in or who's coming in, you know, if for no other reason. I don't want to pull it all out.
Okay, if you have time, I have an aside for you.
Okay.
This probably will cut it out. I spent time in Missouri, a region called Augusta, Missouri. You ever heard of it?
I think so.
Augusta is the first AVA in America, oldest.
I'll bet.
Who would guess that?
Yeah.
One of the reasons why is the little brilliant winemaker guy is the one that figured out that his rootstock was immune, which they shipped millions of roots back to France and saved the French wine industry. I know. And then that guy wound up coming out here and one of the founders of the Napa in our area. And I'm spacing on his name now, but you can look it up.
That is fascinating.
It really is such an unknown story. Ask any one of your friends, what's America's oldest AVA? And not one will know.
No. You know, it's being in the East Coast, when I would go to tasting, there would be a wine from North Carolina. There would be a wine from Missouri. There would be a wine from, well, Michigan. They have the ice wines.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we had, Mari Wells was one of our winemakers at the time. And so it was all women. It was all women winery, which was really fun. We had a ball. She was investigating different vinifera and talking about, you know, this and that. And I'm just looking at her going, I've never heard of that.
Yeah.
So when I went to Michigan to do a tasting and I went to these different tables, and it was really fascinating what they make wine out of anywhere. And I think every state of the union now has some sort of grape.
Well, and the other interesting dynamic, I interviewed the owner of the oldest winery in Virginia, and it's this legendary place. And I said, what's your favorite wine that you make? And he goes, my favorite is beer. He said, I don't like the wine that we make because our customer base likes a sweet wine, and I don't like sweet wine.
I think there's an old adage that a winemaker will drink a lot of beer to make a really good wine. You know, and there was always a six pack somewhere in our refrigerator in the cellar, but it's. I miss that part of crafting, being able to sample, and with the Cabernet, there were years that we would just do 100% Cab, and years that we would do a blend of the Merlot, you know, to it. But I think that overall, looking back, I'm delighted to see how the region has grown with the quality of fruit and the quality of winemaking.
Do you see younger people coming in trying to do startups and grow the industry here locally? Or is it kind of static?
That's a really good question. I think that I know that one of our buddies just sold his winery to someone out of the Bay Area, and they know nothing about it. I believe that they're a little bit younger.
Right. Well, if they don't know anything, they don't have any fear.
No, you're correct. Neither did I when I came up here. I had no fear.
If you knew now, what
and
you
I
knew
did, and it's yeah, like I said, if I knew then what I know now, it would be a little bit different.
Yeah.
I don't see a tremendous amount of youth coming into it. I have four children that we're out in the field, we're over at the winery, we're, you know, doing barrels, doing pruning and all of that. And let's see, two are teachers, one is a dean of students, one works for the government, and one works for a nonprofit.
Oh, how funny. So they all learned their lesson.
They did. They love the ranch. They do love the ranch.
Yeah, and they still come back.
They still come back, and they have kids, and the kids just look at the tractors. And
So you don't make them into baby cellar rats, the kids?
No.
You could.
It'd be fun to have them on tractors, when we're pruning or when we're harvesting. Yeah. But unfortunately, they're all busy doing their other things.
You contract out for your harvest?
We do. Uh-huh. You really have to have contract labor up here.
And is it all hand?
It is. Uh-huh. Everything that we do is hand cultivated, hand picked, because of when we planted.
Your spacing.
The spacing. And also just the topography itself.
Yeah, tractors would tip over.
It doesn't lend itself to machine harvesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
One of the things when we opened the winery, Ironstone, the Couts family was just building their facility, and I think that was also another incredible draw for people to see what capabilities we had. Mm-hmm. And I really
salute. So you were a pioneer in modern iteration.
Yes. With working with Barden Stevenot and then branching out and doing it on our own, there were any number of gentlemen coming over from Amador and coming to the vineyard and looking at me going, "You're never going to make it. A woman doesn't make it in this industry. This is in the early 1980s. Yeah. And I'm like, okay. And we're all very dear friends, still very dear friends, but I'm still at it.
I interviewed the founder of Paraiso Springs Winery in the Santa Lucia Highlands. And I go, I think it was Richard, I go, "You were one of the pioneers of the Monterey County vintners, modern iteration in the 70s. That's so cool." He says, "Yeah, us pioneers, we're the ones that have arrows in our asses." He'd plant 20 acres or something he thought would do great. And 5 years later, they're tearing out the 20 and planting something else.
It was, when referring to the Couts family, I think it gave other people, whether they made money in tech or computers or what, upside down cakes or whatever it was, it gave them the opportunity, because properties here were less expensive than going to Napa or Sonoma or elsewhere. But they have brought so many people to our region and introduced so many people to just the wine industry, the vineyard industry. They, along with Barden, have really brought a lot here. I can't say that I have. I mean, I'm one of the old timers, but
maybe you're being modest too.
I've had friends that have moved up here and friends that have been over in the Napa area that have sold their property and come up here and or gone to Amador County. But I think that seeing the quality and seeing the style of building and crafting that all of us have been able to do is really, it's added something to this community itself. And it's not just Murphy's, it's McCallamy Hill, it's Angel's Camp, it's San Andreas Mountain Ranch.
We could go on and on, but I'm gonna have to come back and we'll go out and kick tires on the back 40.
Yeah, cool. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. How do we learn more about your world?
That's a really good question.
Do you have a website?
We do. It's Chatham Vineyards, Chatom Vineyards with an S.com.
That's too easy.
Yeah, it is. It is easy. And my name is Gay Callen.
Awesome. What a pleasure. This has been fun. And I want to go out and kick some dirt claws with you.
Well, when you come back, we'll have to have you out to the ranch.
I would love
it. It really is breathtaking.
All right. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We'll see you up here in the back 40. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a visit with Bonnie, the co-owner of Hinterhaus Distillery, located in Arnold, Calaveras County, California. Hinterhaus produces an array of spirits, including classic single malt whiskey, rye whiskey, bourbon, and gin. Come along and join the conversation with Bonnie to discover the rest of the story.
My name is Bonnie Boglioli Randall, and together with my husband, I own and operate Hinterhouse Distilling. And we are a distillery nestled in the Sierra Nevada in the town of Arnold, California.
That's so cool. How and when and why did it start?
This is the big question, yeah. Right? So I do have my husband to thank for this. He became involved in distilling after many years of doing home brewing. And I really honestly thought that it was just a fun side project mm-hmm. for him and that it would stay that way. I had a lot of experience in the wine industry myself, working in different AVAs in California. But then I also have a background in hospitality and marketing of hospitality. So eventually my husband said, I think that I want to do this distilling thing full time. Mm-hmm. And I think that we could really make a go of it.
What made him think that he could do that?
He is a problem-solving guy. And the more he got into the art and craft of distillation, the more he really wanted to explore more. And there was really only one way to do that, because in our country, in fact, in every country in the world, save for New Zealand, distilling is something that is illegal to do on your own. Mm-hmm. You have to obtain a federal license to distill, called right. the DSP. So in order to kind of take it up to the level that he really wanted to, mm-hmm. we knew that, okay, you have to become an official distiller with a DSP, and that means we're starting our own business.
Legit.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
When you look at a pro forma going into it, is there a scale, an optimal, you know, level that gives you the best potential for return on investment?
Yeah, this was a huge question. So when we entered, I'll preface by saying we were fortunate in our lives that my husband had worked in the corporate world mm-hmm. for all of his career.
So he had a little baseline.
We did. Yeah. And really, we were able to do this. It was much more than a passion project. It was absolutely a business. And we really spent more than a year going through the nitty-gritty details. But we were also okay with saying, hey, let's produce the best juice, in this case whiskeys mm-hmm. and vodka and gin, that we can, and if it can sustain itself in our hometown of Arnold, then we were good with that. Mm-hmm. Now, since then, that predates when we opened. That goes back to 2018 and 2019. Since then, the distillery has grown just through different recognition, awards, patronage has really significantly increased. So that's caused us to kind of reassess, okay, this maybe is something that we want to scale more than our wildest dreams mm-hmm. before, but how mm-hmm. do we do that thoughtfully and intentionally?
Yeah, and not get in trouble.
Yeah, right, never.
Get out on the edge.
Exactly. You
know. Interesting.
Yeah.
In your philosophy, what role does, what role plays in looking back at the roots of the spirits industry in yeah. California? For example, Hopland, California.
Yep.
I mean, it's not there anymore, no. really, but 100 years ago, 150.
I always tell my patrons that are history buffs, of which I am one certainly, that in the early days of California, whiskey in some households, and I'm not condoning this, mm-hmm. was drank more than water.
In Scotland, yeah. whiskey is called uscavaya
yep.
in Gaelic, which yep. means the breath of life. And what wow. you're alluding to is just incredible, in that if you drank the water in California 150 years ago, you died.
Yes, this was a very real issue. So I find it really fascinating that here in Calaveras County, California, where we are, our history is intertwined and interwoven with the American Gold Rush, and a lot of the men and women that came west seeking their fortunes knew whiskey as a reliable source of something to drink, and again, something that was easy to trade. So whiskey was a very prominent thing here up until Prohibition.
How do you guys loop in and pay homage yeah. to that in yeah. your industry, in your distillery?
Yes. for us, our very first priority is every spirit we produce, we want it to reflect our region of the Sierra Nevada. Mm-hmm. And that encompasses all of its history and what people think of. I grew up on the East Coast, and to me, the California West and the Sierra Nevada was always this mythical place, and it remains that way. I remember the first time that I visited Yosemite, the first time I came here to Calaveras County and visited the giant sequoia at Big Tree State Park. It was just this iconic thing that somehow was infused in my own memory, even though at that point I had never been here. Mm-hmm. So with every spirit we produce, we want to bring a sense of terroir, to take that from the wine industry. We want people to actually taste a part of our neck of the Sierra. So for our vodka, which is the best USA vodka this year from the World Vodka Awards,
wow,
to our gin, which was the gin of the year from Sunset Magazine last year.
This is crazy.
It's pretty cool. Yeah. Those are distilled from local wine. Mm-hmm. So we say they're grape distilled, and we partner with nearby wineries. We get wonderful, generally rich red wine varietals, mm-hmm, that grow so well in the Sierra foothills here. And we turn them into our award-winning vodka and gin. And then the whiskeys we equally have fun with. Our American single malt whiskey is a newer product for us, though it has been aging since we've opened our doors. Mm. And we are utilizing some native yeast, so we do open fermentation,
wow,
at our distillery, and we're sourcing 100% Northern California barley, shining a spotlight on the farmers of our area. So basically everything we do really comes down to paying homage to this part of California and the West.
And how about the barrel aging?
Yeah, the barrel aging is huge.
Yeah, because you can tweak the smoothness big time.
Absolutely. And with whiskeys, barrel aging is really where the distiller gets to roll up their sleeves and have some fun in the sandbox. Mm-hmm. My husband and our son are our two distillers, so seeing them work together on aging our whiskeys and some other spirits, we produce brandy as well, is really where they get to have fun, mm-hmm, and be creative, put a stamp.
And patience.
Very. Very.
I mean, you're talking years, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. No, it really is a long time. So for that reason, the longer our distillery is around, the more we look forward to introducing our patrons and guests to a broader array, mm-hmm, of what we have been quietly barrel aging for the past 4 years.
So they keep sneaking in and stealing a little to see how it's going, right?
Yep. No, that's exactly, mm-hmm, it. And you really have to keep your eye on it.
Yeah.
With our bourbon whiskey, which we produce, bourbon has a slew of bourbon laws. Chief among them would be that bourbon is distilled primarily from a mash of corn, mm-hmm, and it must...
What, 51%?
Exactly. Yeah. A minimum of 51%. And it has to be aged in new, charred, white American oak barrels. So that doesn't change from bourbon to bourbon. That, mm-hmm, gives bourbon a lot of the attributes that, as consumers, we look for. However, once it's completed its aging, you are allowed to move it into what we refer to as finishing barrels. Mm-hmm. This is a secondary aging process.
Oh, interesting.
And we use Calaveras County wine barrels,
wow,
to finish our bourbon. Some of the batches will sit in the wine barrels for up to 6 months. So it's, mm-hmm, more than just a few days. We really want the wine that has seeped into the walls of the barrels, mm-hmm, to really blend and marry and add character to our bourbon. So it's a fun one.
That's so funny. Back in the day, the Scots loved the American bourbon industry because that's how they could get cheap barrels. And then even, yep, better, Macallan, I love this. Back in the day, they would go and buy in the docks of Liverpool used sherry hogshead casks purely because it was cheap.
Yep.
And it wasn't until 12 or 14 years later that they went, oh my God. And that's why I fell in love with single malt, was because of Macallan's, because of their sherry cask aging.
Totally right there with, yeah, you. We absolutely share a passion for single malt whiskey. Mm-hmm. And obviously that is the whiskey of Scotland. We craft an American single malt. We're really proud to be a producer of American, oh, single malt. It's a pretty nascent but growing type of whiskey in this country. And again, we're trying to leverage some of the best things that we love from our favorite scotches, but put them into the context of a California single malt.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
So are you going face to face with the Scots?
That's really funny. Yeah. Kind of. Yes. Yeah. So for Hinterhaus itself, our American single malt, we've only released a couple of batches at this time. So it's not super widespread. We do ship some around the country, and we have distribution partners in California and Colorado who carry that product. But for the most part, you got to come here to get it.
Mm-hmm. Literally to the source.
Really, yeah. Literally to the source. Mm-hmm. But we are members of the American Single Malt Commission, which is a group of American distillers. Some of them are quite large and then others are small, and we're all producing single malt. And I do believe that they have put up some billboards in the beautiful country of Scotland touting the American single malt, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
So it's something to be on the lookout for people that are interested in emerging whiskeys.
That's interesting, because going back in time, it was the Japanese who just took off and went viral with their own concoctions. Yeah.
It's really fun, and it allows us to always be rethinking or redefining whiskey as we know it, because I feel like whiskey has obviously such an old tradition and heritage around the world, going back to Scotland and Ireland, and then in the United States amongst the American colonists early on. But that doesn't mean that we need to be stuck into doing things the way it has always been done. We can learn from those past traditions, but hopefully at Hinterhaus, we're really trying to bring something unique that you're not going to find in other bottles.
Cool. A moment, paint a picture of, you have a tasting room, a retail venue. Where are you located, and what would somebody find there?
Great. Yes. So we are along Highway 4 in the small town of Arnold, California. We now have, I would say about 7,000 square feet of space. Most of it is devoted to our production facilities. So we do open air fermentation in a huge 2,000 gallon fermentation tank. We have our distillery production entirely there, and our barrel warehouse is there. But in addition, we always invite people to stop in and see us. We open our doors to the public Thursday through Sunday, and our hours are on our website and social media, which I always tell people, please find us on Instagram. And we have a lovely, hopefully very welcoming tasting room. We have a bottle shop. We have a small mercantile shop that sells our gear. And we also have the unique offering of making cocktails. So we handcraft cocktails. There is a limit. Everyone is limited to one per day. And that's a unique state law having to do with distilling. But we hope that it invites people to come and linger and see for themselves how our spirits taste in the context of a great drink.
Can somebody order a bottle and have it shipped?
Yes, thank you for asking. So we ship through distribution partners on our website to 41 states across the country.
Cool.
So chances are good that wherever you are or your friends and family are, we could get you some bottles of our
Nine that don't, that's some Neanderthal laws, right?
There are some very unique laws in the distilling space, and a lot of them actually go back to Prohibition. Effectively, in the state of California, it's only been in the last decade or so that distilleries could sell direct to their consumers, let alone taste their product.
Real recently, yeah.
Yes. So I do suspect a lot of these laws will evolve and change with time. But right now, we try not to let them constrain us. We try to get people our spirits wherever they are if we can.
That's so cool. To learn more about your world.
Yes, so please head on over to Hinterhaus, and Haus is spelled the German way for house, H-A-U-S, distilling.com. You will be able to learn all about my family-owned and operated distillery in Calaveras County, California. You can have our hours there. You can have our spirits shipped to you. And, of course, you can follow us on social media, also at Hinterhaus Distilling.
I love it. Now I want to taste.
Bonnie Boglioli Randall, Winter House Distilling in the town of Arnold, California.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We'll see you at Winter House.
You've been listening to the travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station.